This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. Today we have a very interesting topic that has something to do with college, Bermuda shorts, and maybe even underwear. I don't know why that all fits in, but it's part of the package of a wonderful and entertaining series of stories included in the beautifully illustrated collection, Molly McDougal, Montgomery McGrath, and Other Stories to Make You Laugh. Joining me from I think it's Baltimore, Maryland, is our author.
That's correct, Jay.
George Cooper. Thanks, George, for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
What's the significance of underwear? Well, we know the significance of underwear in some people's worlds, but in yours it had a particular significance related to this book, this novel, this series of stories you wrote.
Well, not so much underwear, but Bermuda shorts. I wrote in response to my mother gave my brother and I, who's 4 years younger than me, a pair of matching Madras beach shirts with no collar and white piping, and she told us to walk around the neighborhood and show all the neighbors our new outfits.
All right.
And I wasn't very enthusiastic about it, and she let me know it. So that was the basis of Bermuda shorts, and it's funny when my mother read the story that I wrote many years later. She said, "This is about those Bermuda shorts, isn't it?" And I didn't say anything. I didn't want to hurt her feelings, but she knew what the story was.
Sure. Did you always have an obtuse or a unique outlook on life? This obviously is a part of your package, maybe.
I like to think so. I think that life without humor is rather difficult. So I try to find humor in as many situations as I can. And usually I'm able to do it. Every once in a while I can't, but I find it makes life more livable.
Well, the foundation of your book and the idea to write this I'll call it a novel, it's really kind of a series of short stories.
It's a series of short stories, right?
It really started in college. In college, you were involved in media also. How did that
That's
lay a
correct.
Foundation for you?
Well, I ended up in the optical business, so that... I guess that'll give you an indication
mm-hmm.
of how well the major worked out for me. But it was something I enjoyed, and I did write a few things in college that the other students seemed to appreciate it. And Molly McDougal was one of those things that I wrote, and I put the story in a dresser drawer. And many, many years later, I happened to notice it, and I thought, oh, this is pretty good, but it really needs some editing. So I decided to edit it and see if I could make it come out all right, and the editing seemed to make the difference between something written by a 20-year-old and something written by a 45-year-old is, I guess, just like anything in life, quite different.
Different perspective,
but,
obviously.
But I had fun with it and decided to see where it would go.
Are you still in? You're not in media. I thought by reading your notes that you were retired. Are you retired or are you?
I am retired.
You are retired.
I am retired, and that's part of my code for enjoying your life is to retire, no matter what the age, whether you're 7 or 8 years old and you've had enough of grammar school or. You're closing in on 70 like me, and you just want to take life easy. Retirement is the key.
I guess the significance of your story is that if you have a desire to be an author, to write, or whatever your passion is in life, don't give up on it and keep those stories sitting around. Maybe it'll come into importance later in life.
Yes, it has been fun. Just writing the stories, you know, keeps me off the street, keeps me from falling in with the wrong crowd, and I find relaxing and very enjoyable at the same time.
It's over 102 pages, and to describe it for our listeners, the illustrations are spectacular. Who is your target audience with this series of novels, or series of stories, I'm sorry?
Well, I would say the real target audience is 7 to 9, but children at a younger age enjoy the artwork, even if they don't always get the stories. And I guess starting at about 4, they seem to start to understand the stories. But sometimes 4 and younger, they really don't understand it, but they can still enjoy the artwork. But I would say if there's a real age that I had in mind is probably 7 to 9.
And you have written in poetry, I would call it, I guess. How in the world did that happen? You have obviously some skills that were not evident in your earlier career.
Well, yes, I did write it in verse, and it's just something I feel comfortable in, and I think that the language of verse is kind of easy on the ears, especially for children, and they're drawn to it. So since I felt comfortable writing in verse, I thought, well, we might as well give it a shot and see how it goes. And I've gotten a good response in general, but the children in particular seem to enjoy the verse.
Any children or grandchildren stimulate your desire to get this published?
Yes, my granddaughter came along, and and I started to think about the book again. She's 15 now, so she's a little bit older, but she was kind of my motivation to get the process rolling again, to see if I could do something with my stories.
Is your main character Molly McDougal Montgomery McGrath in all of the stories?
No, she's just in the one story about refusing to take a bath. There are 4 very different stories. Let's see, there's Molly McDougal, Bermuda Shorts, about a young man who gets a present he's not particularly fond of. Then there's one about keeping secrets. And the last one is about Fedora Flats, which is completely and utterly whimsical.
Mm. Keeping secrets, has that anything to do with, was there a frog involved in one of your stories? Or am I thinking of something
that
else?
Yes, that was the frog. Yes, when a big blue frog swallowed my brother, I did not tell my father or mother. I thought they would like to know, but I knew that they would worry, so.
Oh, beautiful.
I did not scream. I did not shout. I asked the frog to spit him out. So
that's beautiful.
Be careful about asking me to quote something.
I guess. any books of Dr. Seuss lying around, maybe in your attic, that might have inspired you?
It's funny. I tried to not be too Dr. Seussy, but obviously I didn't. I didn't escape that. I guess there are worse people to be compared to.
Oh,
you
absolutely.
Want to have your own voice, but Dr. Seuss is pretty darn good too.
Absolutely,
so
beautiful.
I'll take that.
Absolutely, the 102 pages must have taken a while. George, did you concentrate on this after retirement? How long did it take to get this edited and ready for print?
You know, I always take a writing course. And I would periodically write children's stories, and it took about 5 years before I felt like I had enough children's stories to make a complete book. And that was when I went to Balboa Press to do the artwork. I had I hoped to entice a friend to maybe do the artwork for me and split the profits, but it would have been quite a commitment, and I couldn't find anybody. I have plenty of friends who should be committed, but nobody wanted to commit to this project. So,
well, the illustrations are spectacular.
I was really pleased. I was really pleased.
Was that any complicated issue, or were they just able to just embrace the stories and run with it?
I guess they were. As a matter of fact, I was so pleased that I tried to call Balboa Press and talk directly to the person who did the artwork, but that's a no-no. So I just said, left a message, just tell him or her that I was very pleased.
It is very well done. The colors are great, and of course the characters are just amazing, and it ties in so beautifully with your stories. Was there any underlying message other than the fact that you wanted to have fun and make people laugh when you shared these stories?
No, not really. If I inadvertently came up with any serious messages, I apologize. I wanted chuckles more than anything else.
Well, you've achieved it. Are there more stories in the pipeline? Are you going to release an additional follow-up book to this?
Well, if this does reasonably well, or at least well enough for me to get my investment back and maybe a few dollars more, there definitely will be a second book. I have four other stories that are in need of illustration So we'll just see how it goes.
Well, it's visually impressive and beautifully done. The stories are a lot of fun. I think children of any age, including old ones like me, would find this a great addition to their library. The title of the book, again, is Molly McDougal, Montgomery McGrath, and Other Stories to Make You Laugh. Our author, George Cooper. George, I need to get this in the hands of my listeners. How do they get a hold of it?
You know, I've got 16 books left, and I can't find one of them when I look for them, but here we go. I did find it. It's through Balboa Press, available at www.balboa.com.
Super. They can also do a search online under your name, George Cooper, just as it sounds.
That's right.
Amazon Press probably will carry this and several other locations. Their local bookseller can order it in by the author's name, George Cooper, and also by the title, Molly McDougal Montgomery McGrath. That's a mouthful. Beautifully done. Best of luck with this in the future, and if things go well, I would love to visit with you again and share the follow-up book. I have a feeling is going to be coming out in the near future. Thanks for joining me today, George.
Well, I hope so, Jay, and thank you, Jay.
Pleasure visiting with you. For Indie Book Publishing, Balboa Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
Listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you, call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
The title of the book, Stories in Your Hands. Discover your authentic destiny using palmistry and tarot. And the author is Cynthia Clark. And Cynthia joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Cynthia.
Hello.
Great to have you with us, and this is going to be a very fascinating discussion about our hands and also how it's tied to tarot, two ancient and accurate tools, as you say, to guide readers and deep understanding of their true selves. Your book is a guidebook.
Yes, the book is actually a personality profiling book. So it helps you understand who you are from a subconscious level. Your hands actually form their shape by the time you are about 6 years old. So you can think about by the time you're born to the time you're 6 years old, you're completely in your subconscious mind and you're being formed. You know, you're like a piece of clay. Okay, so to speak, you're just absorbing everything around you. And that absorption will reflect through your hands. So by the time you are about 6 years old, your hands will be set, okay? And this setting creates a set of personality traits that will affect you for the rest of your life.
And you call these personality traits archetypes.
Carl Jung was the first psychologist really famous for talking about these unconscious influences and talking about these archetypes. I've come through with a different spin to help people understand it through the hands, and they happen to correspond with the tarot cards, which are a set of cards that actually represent the soul's journey through life. And they're called the major arcana, and what they do is they take you from the fool's journey, that's the first card, all the way through to the world, which is the last card. And each one of those is actually symbolic of these personality traits. Yeah, these traits tie right in with your hands.
Now, this is your personal journey as well. This ancient science,
yes,
really changed your life.
My career was at a crossroads. A lot of people, especially now, go through many different career changes. They say the average now is 7 career changes in your lifetime, which is quite a bit more than what we used to have. So, you know, I was in my 30s. And I had run a restaurant. I was in the restaurant industry for many, many years. And it was just time to do something different. And it's not that I was, you know, unsuccessful or whatever. I was actually very successful in my restaurant business. But it was just time to do something else. You know, you get burned out. You get tired of doing the same thing all the time. You know, anyone who out there who's run a restaurant knows what I'm talking about.
Right.
It's a lot of work. And eventually you do get burned out unless you can, you know, lessen your hours. I mean, I used to put in about 100 hours a week, which is, you know, basically you're living your restaurant and that's it. So when you think about a life in balance, I wasn't too balanced. So in that way, I guess you could say I was self-destructing. So I had just decided to, you know, let it all go and start fresh. Had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. I'm still pretty young at this point. And obviously, you know, in my working years. And that's when I found hand analysis and palmistry. And I come from a very logical business background. I have a degree in business, actually. So, you know, I didn't come from the angle of, you know, a gypsy fortune teller, so to speak. I came from the rational, you know, business perspective, the analytical perspective. And I really didn't know anything about it. And when I read this book on palmistry, I just had a really profound deja vu experience where I felt not only that I had studied it before, but that I had studied it in other lifetimes before. And it was very, I mean, the feeling, if you've ever had deja vu, it's very strange. So I ended up studying, you know, again, even though it was my first time studying it. And I just picked it up really easily, really quickly. It was just so natural to me. And it was sort of like a light bulb going on in my brain. It's like, oh, here it is. Click, you know, turn the light on. It was so interesting. So that's how I got into palm reading.
And through that, you got into a new career?
Yes, I ended up studying for about a year, reading as many people as I could find. And I had lots of acquaintances and lots of volunteers. It was very nice because you do have to get in your practice. And I decided to go full time after about a year. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So I've worked with about 7,000 people now.
So this is as you write about it, it's a like a mirror. When you look at your hand, like I'm looking at the palm of my hand, and I see a bunch of lines, it's a mirror of who I am. In fact, you even say it reflects your true desires, your purpose, and even your values. You can read that.
Yes, you can. Your hands are just an extension of your brain. And the lines in the hand will mimic the neural pathways in your brain. And they ebb and flow. They change over time. You can see stress. You can see how you think, how you feel. You can see, you know, preferences, relationship compatibilities and preferences. I mean, all kinds of stuff. Your willpower, how you see yourself, how you present yourself. You know, it's just such a detailed map of who you are. And I think people discount it a little bit, and that is unfortunate, and I'd like to switch that around for, you know, people's just to, you know, it's not what most people think, in that, you know, you're like, how long you're going to live, for example, is not in your hands. So if anybody tells you, oh, I have a short lifeline, I'm going to die at, you know, young age, that's not accurate. Your lines change, okay? So your hands are reflecting your vitality, your stability, you know, and yes, the future is in the hands, but it's not set. You know, you can change your pathway. You do have free will to change your pathway. And I've seen all kinds of stuff of watching people's hands over years of time and tracking the changes. But, you know, it's good to understand the base, which is the personality archetypes, and the soul imprint, and how that overlays into your everyday existence. It's such a useful tool for people. And I think if everybody would study it, they would be not only happier, but they would be more in their authentic self, which is what I try to teach people. It's like if you are, you know, being what your hands are saying makes you happy, then why wouldn't you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to know what that's saying? You know, so I try to help unlock people's potential. That's ultimately what I do.
And in your book, you have photos of hands, and the same hands at a different time, and you can see from the photos how those lines change.
Yes, they definitely can. And so, you know, I really do enjoy the time lapse, working with people over years of time. It's so much fun to, you know, take an ink print and see where you're at, you know, because it's basically a snapshot when you do an ink print of where you are today. And then we can start to track it. So you come back to me 6 months later or whatever, and we can do another print, and we can actually see what's going on and how things are evolving. And, you know, the right hand and left hand also tell a little bit of a different story. So you look at the passive hand to show some potentials that maybe want to come out, but they're maybe not developed yet or not ready yet, or, you know, it could just be an optional thing for you. I like to show people the differences on the two hands as well.
So the lines, whether they're horizontal predominantly or along with vertical lines, that all means something.
Absolutely. Yeah, the lines are actually the most complicated part of palm reading, and it gets a little bit confusing. But, you know, if with a trained expert like myself, I can help you navigate through the whole thing.
And also also the way your fingers, whether they're straight or bent, or that means something.
Absolutely. Most people do not have all straight fingers. So when a finger starts to bend, that is actually a type of stress. And depending upon what finger it is, what is the stress relating to? So if you look at, I would say the number one bend on people's hands is their middle finger, and it tends to bend towards their ring finger. That's the most common bend that I've noticed. And of course, the middle finger relates to your attitudes towards work and duties and responsibilities. So, you know, and when we look at our society, we're all stressed out about that stuff, you know. So it's showing a worry and a stress over, like, your everyday decision-making. And, you know, it's really interesting how, you know, people with money problems, people with, you know, they're just, like, getting by, you know, in their day-to-day life. It's like, well, that middle finger is going to show that stress.
And how does the reading of palms, palmistry, then relate to the use of cards?
Yeah, so this is where I have made a connection that I'm pretty sure no one else has made in the palmistry world. Tarot is, like I said, it's the soul's journey. There's 78 cards, actually. 22 are called the major arcana, and the remaining 56 are called the minor arcana, which is big secrets and little secrets. And it's the number one divination tool in the world. People will, they will read tarot cards in order to not only predict the future, but also for any, basically any question you can ask the cards and you can get answers to things. But, you know, where I've made the connection is through the major arcana cards, the 22 big secrets cards. And each one of those corresponds to a personality archetype, which corresponds to your hands. So you can actually identify not only who you are through the cards, but you can also, and everybody has between one and three of these archetypes. And so it helps give you a whole new way of looking at yourself and understanding yourself, you know, just like astrology does, just like numerology does, just like Myers-Briggs does, you know, if you want to go the psychology route. All of these tools are diagnostics to understand yourself better, and this is just another tool that you can use to really gain understanding. And it can help you to find balance, it can help you to understand other people, it can help you understand your relationships, your compatibilities, your preferences, and just how to be in harmony with that energy. So it's a very useful tool for people.
We've been talking with Cynthia Clark. She is the author of her book, Stories in Your Hands. What is the best way, Cynthia, to get your book?
Well, you can definitely go to my website, worldofhands.com or storiesinyourhands.com. And you can access it that way. You can also get it through Archway Publishing. You can get it through Amazon. It's available in hardcover, softcover, ebook formats. You can go to Barnes & Noble. I mean, it's out there. It's really easy to find.
Thank you so much, Cynthia, for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing West Bow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book deals with an important topic, and the title is Homeless, I Have Known. And my author who joins me from Indiana is author Muriel Drake Ryan. Dr. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Welcome, Jay, and just call me Muriel.
All right, I'm happy to do so. Your book is a relatively short read. You have an extensive background dealing with this issue. Share with the audience a little of that background and what the impetus was behind your sharing these stories and getting this book to press.
I spent many of my professional years as an educator and working with families and working with the idea of collaborative learning. And then just before I totally retired, I did a guest professorship at St. Mary's College here in Terre Haute. And then I moved from there to working with the issue of poverty. My last semester, I taught a class that introduced me to Ruby Payne's book on poverty. And I worked with during the summer, but then I realized that there were people that we couldn't just treat out of a storefront ministry. We needed to end up having some place for them to live. Mm. And that's where Families by Choice came from.
When you say someplace to live, did you establish a large dwelling for people who are street people, or was it individual residences? How did that come about?
We went with large houses here in Terre Haute. Terre Haute has a number of historic large houses. We have a men's shelter called Timothy's House, a women's shelter called Deborah's House, which was the first one we opened. And then about 5 years ago, we discovered that there were some parents that felt that they just couldn't deal with the issues of autism, and they would literally put these kids on the street, or the kids would, in frustration, run away.
Wow.
And so we established what we call Project Jonathan, which works with the mentally challenged.
I have a brother-in-law who is emotionally and mentally challenged, but he's very bright in many ways, and he lives with us and actually is a wonderful addition to our family. He's just loaded with, to some it'd be useless information. He has a lot of detail. He's a detailed personality, but he is actually a treasure to have around. We enjoy his living with us. There are some other issues that happen on the streets in Texas, where I'm located. We see many people who are taking on the robe, if I may use that term, of homelessness and begging on the streets. And yet there is a question mark about some of these individuals. It doesn't appear that they are incapacitated either intellectually or physically. There seems to be a method of using homelessness to maybe deceive the public. That is causing a negative impact on the people who really have needs, is it not?
Yes, yes. And frankly, we've come up with a method to curb that. We have wristbands that have the name of our organization on them as well as a telephone number.
Fabulous.
And we will, and we encourage people to put them in their wallet, in their purse, or wear them on their wrist and give that away. And I will say, we will screen them. If they really need help, they need food, they need resources, we know our community, we know where we can direct them if they really have a need, but we will screen them. And if you look in your rearview mirror and they've thrown this thing over their shoulder after you gave it to them, mm-hmm. then you did not find someone who had a real need.
Absolutely.
They had a real need, they'd use that, because most of them could get a cell phone. Most of them will be able to get a cell phone through having food stamps. And so they can call us. And we will screen them, and we will hook them up with the right resources. So that's one of the things that we've done. We have a Walmart that's famous for having people standing with cardboard signs as you exit. We've got a Highway 70 interstate that many people will find folks standing there as they get off the highway and come into Terre Haute, and they're standing there with a sign. We will screen them. We will make sure that only those that have a real need will get the services.
You're doing something on a community level that is traceable, trackable, and commendable, of course. In my community, how does one go about finding a way to assist these individuals that really have needs and are desperate for help?
I would actually start with finding through your government a homeless coalition. HUD has an expectation that there will be an effort to deal with a lack of affordable housing. And so they have a requirement that you have a homeless coalition or a coalition of folks that are dealing with folks that are lacking housing or are finding it difficult to find affordable housing. So each government center should have, under community development, should have a committee of this sort. In each state, each one of our 50 states. But I would find those folks that have an organization, that have a shelter for the homeless, and get to know them very well. Have them out to your church. Find out what their major challenges are. Now, we're in a situation where we established a program that would not allow us to get any government money whatsoever.
That's a different approach, and probably some serious reasons behind that from a personnel standpoint. You have outlined several personal stories in here of individuals who are in that difficult period of homelessness. Have you come across individuals who are highly educated that either through emotional distress or some other factor have ended up on the streets?
Yes, we found people that are very articulate and have a wide vocabulary and a good work experience that somehow just cannot connect with the world or got disconnected from a large corporation. Normally, they don't stay for the duration of our program that now lasts for a year. But we do find that every person that comes in, no matter what their status is, whether they have a learning disability, a mental health issue, or have been very sophisticated in their life, the short story is they're almost always to a person come in very depressed, feeling very unworthy because they've reached a point in life where they don't have the resources to put a roof over their head.
Incredibly difficult.
We work hard to make sure that that's one of the first things we deal with, is their sense of non-worth.
In reading your book, what is the reader going to find besides the general story of individuals? Is there one or two people that really made an impact and caused your ministry to go forward?
I would say that it wasn't one or two. It was a continued repetition of often the same problem. And that has to do with a general sense of not feeling like they're part of a family, a general sense of not feeling like they belong, frustration with whatever is necessary to move forward and make choices. I can't think of one or two other than the fact that I do recall the gentleman that I do tell a story of that he always apologized. He had a very fitful youth and he was in his early 40s and he looked at me one day and apologized again for something that was not his fault. And I turned around on my heel and I said, "I love you because God loved you first." And I'm going to let the readers find out what happened next.
Wow. Well, I'm ready to find out myself. I was going, wow, well, this is a cliffhanger. I know it's going to be good. You have also mentioned that you have homes for ladies or women who are going through distress and difficult times. Is there a preponderance of that comes from domestic abuse, or is it just circumstantial evidence or circumstantial things, maybe from addiction or maybe from self-esteem issues that are causing them to be in this situation?
I think it's a little bit of everything that you just listed. I will be truthful to the fact that the first five, I learned really quickly, the first five women we served, four out of the first five had been raped before they were 16.
Wow.
A different four out of the first five had been in foster care. And the complexity of being second generation of not knowing how to parent correctly is probably the thing that let us know right away that we were on the right track, that teaching them how to parent and teaching them how to be part of a cohesive group that loved and cared one another and counted on one another was critical. One word that we had to drop from our vocabulary almost entirely was the word father. And so we began to approach the gospel from the values that are taught in Galatians 5, the gifts of the Spirit, and then also to take a look at those things that Paul refers to in Philippians, the things that we should think upon. And so we looked at those values and we built from there. And but father was something that could literally bring out hives. Wow. And because there had been such traumatic, either from biological or stepfather or whatever. And so not understanding how to respect oneself and one's body was a concern that had to be dealt with. And valuing them as people.
You deal with a very important, prejudice by many people that these individuals on the street that we see, especially because I think of the difficulty we have with individuals holding signs and begging, that they're just stinkers. They just don't really care about themselves or other people. They're out for selfish reasons. But that's not the case, and those stories come through in the book that you have written.
Well, and I think that's really critical, and that was part of the reason the book was written, was to end up kicking those stereotypes out the door and recognizing the fact that there were people below that level of what they were seeing that are in desperate straits. And we need to recognize the fact that they're not all stinkers. There are stinkers. I write a whole chapter called Stinkers, and they exist. We have no tolerance for their behaviors. We have no tolerance for alcohol. We do collaborate with things like Celebrate Recovery Organizations, the AA, and we encourage them to cling to their sobriety. And one of our rules in the house is no drinking, no drugs, because a sober mind makes better decisions.
Beautiful. You have some wonderful concepts in here, but I think the most compelling thing about your book is, first of all, it's a relatively short read. You didn't want to get people bogged down into the negative side of what's happening on the street, I'm guessing. But also, you give some positive solutions, and that is to be commended.
Well, I appreciate that very much. One of the reasons that I wrote the book is, besides the fact that it is our 10th year and we're celebrating 10 years, but we're up against the wall financially, and we need some assistance. But at the same time, I wanted people to have a tool in a community that was about the size of Terre Haute. We've got about 65,000 people here, and spill over from the other counties that do not have. Our area has about 150,000, and we're just one part of dealing with the homeless here in Terre Haute. But at the same time, we're looking at the fact that if we had a bed for each homeless person, and we filled them all, the ones that we have, we would still be 252 beds short.
Wow.
So we still have 252 people to get off the streets and to end up giving them a sense that we will respect them if they come off the streets. So there's a lot of work yet to be done.
You're doing a wonderful gift to them as individuals, as humans, and as people, and as community members. Your organization, I would certainly recommend people get acquainted with it, is titled Families by Choice. Your book here is titled Homeless, I Have Known, and my author, Dr. Muriel Drake Ryan. Where do we get copies of your book, and how do we get involved with what you're doing?
Well, you can get copies of the book from Amazon, Books a Million, and Barnes & Noble online. You can end up writing to me at 164 Allendale Court, Terre Haute, Indiana, 47802. We would appreciate it if you do write us, that you throw in a $10 bill, and I'll put a book in the mail to you.
Oh, fabulous.
The short story is that We want to get the word out. We want to end up spreading the word that the homeless are people. They are human beings that have fallen on hard times. And yes, there are stinkers. And if they're not ready to be served, they're not ready to comply in a reasonable situation where we don't force anything upon them, even our gospel. We end up saying that that's something that each person should end up choosing a church or a house of worship to develop strength. And that's what we encourage. We do not compel them to attend. But we can get the books out to anyone. And I'd be more than happy to end up taking invitations from Illinois and Ohio, Michigan, to come and speak to churches. We have a problem, and as a society and as Christians, we need to remember that Christ told us to take the stranger in.
Thank you for sharing not only this message but the gospel with those in need, and absolutely demonstrating by action what the gospel is all about. Thank you again for sharing your story. The title of the book, again, is Homeless I Have Known. My author guest, Dr. Muriel Drake Ryan, and my assumption is that you take a gift higher than $10 for the book, should they write you. So we'd love to see that take place, and please keep in touch and let us know how things are going.
Oh, I would greatly appreciate that. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Just one more thing.
Sure.
This book will have, about a year from now, we'll have a companion Bible study book that goes with it. It'll be entitled Taking the Stranger In, and so the churches can end up using it with Sunday school classes or for adult vacation Bible school.
Fantastic.
So we have the two books for people to read and making sure that the resources go back into the ministry.
Thank you again for sharing that. For Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing. Join us again next week at noon Eastern.